ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Hello and welcome to PM. I'm Samantha Donovan, coming to you from the lands of the Wurundjeri people of the Kulin Nation in Melbourne. Tonight, the Liberal Party formally abandons its commitment to reaching net zero emissions by 2050. The opposition leader, Susan Lee, says axing net zero can bring down electricity prices. But can she sell that message to Australian voters?
People care about the environment, and I think the Liberal Party seems to think that if they turn around and say to everybody, oh, your electricity will be cheaper, that that's a vote winner. I think they're misunderstanding the population.
And after 6 weeks, the US government shutdown has finally come to an end. First this evening, the Liberal Party has formally dumped its commitment to net zero emissions by 2050. A meeting of the Liberal Party's shadow ministry has today confirmed the decision after yesterday's wider party meeting. The opposition leader, Susan Lee, says the Liberal Party supports Australia staying in the Paris Agreement, that's the international treaty aiming to limit global warming, and if elected to government would set interim climate targets. She says the party's top priority is making energy affordable for Australians, but she believes the reduction of emissions can be achieved too. Rachel Mealy prepared this report.
All right. Well, good afternoon, everybody. Shortly, a little while ago, the Liberal Shadow Ministry decided on our policy.
Deciding that policy has been a tussle between the moderate and conservative voices in her party. Susan Lee laid out the new plan.
Our emissions reduction goals will never come at the expense of Australian families, and this is the principle that will guide every decision we take. To keep faith with that commitment, the Liberal Party will remove a net zero target from our policy.
The party's new position would see it reduce emissions year on year, but not actively strive for net zero by 2050.
We will have an energy and emissions policy driven by two key objectives: affordable, reliable power and responsible emissions reductions. And our energy and emissions policies will use Australian resources for Australian families, so you pay less for your power.
To appease some in her party, the Liberals will remain committed to the Paris Agreement. But Susan Lee says the targets set out in the agreement won't be chased as a priority.
We remain committed to the Paris Agreement and to doing our fair share to reduce emissions. But we will do it in a way that protects households and budgets and keeps our economy strong.
She says she's comfortable facing the consequences of Australia being in breach of the terms of the Paris Agreement.
Overall, Paris is about a global agreement to bring down temperatures and reduce emissions. That's exactly what we propose to do. And we will look Australians in the eye and say, this is a plan to bring down emissions and to provide affordable energy for you. And if there are reasons why people in Paris or in some United Nations organisation don't like it, I can deal with that.
Dan Tehan, who's the shadow energy minister, left open the possibility of Australian investment in carbon capture and storage as a means of reducing emissions. As well, he says all technology is on the table to run Australia's energy grid, including extending the life of coal-fired power stations and keeping the nuclear option open.
We want to be throwing all technologies at emissions reduction. We will be the only party or the only two parties as a coalition that is saying to the Australian people, when it comes to energy abundance, we will use all our resources, and when it comes to reducing emissions, we will also use all the available technology and all the available resources that we have to make sure that we are doing our fair share.
Representatives from the Liberals and the Nationals will get together this weekend to flesh out a joint coalition position on net zero and energy transition. Nationals leader David Littleproud says he's looking forward to being in lockstep with the Liberal Party once again.
And I actually commend the Liberal Party for their leadership in understanding and working with us constructively. And I give the commitment over the coming couple of days that the National Party will work constructively with them to finalise our coalition policy that will start that conversation. Not about science, the science is settled, but about the economics, and say to the Australian people, let's go on that journey.
That's the Nationals leader, David Littleproud. Rachel Mealy reporting. So how will voters respond to the Liberal Party's decision to axe its net zero policy? Polls show young people want decisive action on climate change, while many traditional Liberal voters are now backing Teals and other independents who are committed to net zero by 2050. Our reporter Diana Damjanovic starts this look at voter sentiment in the Sydney harbourside suburb Double Bay in the Teal seat of Wentworth.
Double Bay is a well-off harbourside suburb known for its picturesque setting. It's in the Wentworth electorate, which in the past was a blue ribbon Liberal seat. But Teal independent Allegra Spender turned that on its head, winning the seat at the last two elections. So, can the Libs win it back from the Teals?
To use an old expression, a drover's dog, I reckon, would win for a Teal in here.
This man says the Liberals' confirmation today that they're dumping the net zero target is a mistake.
For a long, long time, it was blue ribbon, and I can understand why. But people care about the environment, and I think the Liberal Party seems to think that if they turn around and say to everybody, oh, your electricity will be cheaper, that that's a vote winner. I think they're misunderstanding the population and they're selling them short.
One of the reasons seats like this were lost by the Liberal Party to the Teal independents was frustration at the party's lack of action on climate change. But some here in Double Bay say the Liberals have made the right move today in dumping net zero.
I think that's right.
Yeah? Why?
Why? Because we're being penalised as a country by a government and Minister of the Environment that has clueless.
This young man agrees. The Libs have made the right call.
Look, I support it. I think that it's just unrealistic, the time period that they put on doing net zero. I think it would stuff up the economy, and I just don't think we have the resources to support it.
And this man says he'll be voting Liberal either way.
It won't convince me, it won't make a difference, but I don't really believe that we need net zero. We need to do something, but within reason.
And you're saying that in a Teal seat?
I am saying in a Teal seat. I believe that there is climate change, but there's been climate change long before I was born.
But the Liberal Party faces a big challenge in winning back enough voters to retake a Teal seat like this one. This young woman says she's disenchanted with the party.
Who do you vote for anymore? Honestly, I actually don't know. Having been a Liberal family my whole life, I just don't know who to vote for anymore. There's no one that's giving me any confidence. I'm not very confident with the leader at the moment.
Apart from winning back the Teal seats, the Liberal Party also faces questions about whether it can attract younger voters who tend to worry more about action on climate change. On the streets of Melbourne, this young person says scrapping net zero is a worrying sign.
I think it's not a great sign for the way that the coalition politics is moving. I think particularly for young people, climate change is a very contentious issue, and you know, we're all pretty passionate about making sure that the world is still there for us when we get to it.
On the other side of the continent in Western Australia, Liberal frontbencher Andrew Hastie holds the electorate of Canning. In that seat is the suburb of Mandurah, and voters there had a mixed reaction to the Libs dumping net zero.
I'm a little bit disturbed by it, I think, and that's mostly because they're not really thinking of the future generations. I voted for Andrew. So that's, I don't know, I don't want to swear, but it's a bit shit.
But this man says the net zero target needs to go.
I think it's great because I don't think we should be a part of net zero while looking to Asia and China and India and other countries that we're going to drop down looking at net zero and they're looking at polluting.
residents of Mandurah in Andrew Hastie's seat of Canning in WA. That report from Diana Damjanovic. Professor Mark Kenny is the director of the Australian Studies Institute at the Australian National University. He had a long career in the Canberra Press Gallery reporting on the climate policies of both sides of politics. He suggested to me that in changing their policy on net zero, Liberal MPs are focusing more on internal party politics than what a majority of voters want.
There are people who are quite delusional, in my view, about where the Australian people are. They think they can turn this into purely an argument about energy prices, but I think that's actually going to be quite difficult. Partly this is because they've done it before. They did it quite successfully under Tony Abbott's leadership, but these were different circumstances, and I think the question they're really struggling to answer now, and Susan Lee was, I think, under some pressure about this, as was Dan Tehan and others in that press conference today. That question is, how much are power prices going to come down? When would that happen? By what mechanism could it occur? Given that renewables are the cheapest form of energy, how does whatever changes you make in abandoning net zero actually deliver cheaper power prices? I think all of those arguments are going to be quite difficult to land. And yet that's what sits at the base of this policy, this idea that the Australian voters are getting tired of hearing about climate change because they're under pressure at, you know, the hip pocket, particularly from energy prices. And therefore they're going to try and, as Abbott did in that period between 2010 and 2013, completely sort of reorient the debate into one about household economics rather than long-term environmental concerns.
Yes, so no doubt the promise of cheaper energy bills will appeal to many voters, even if it's not clear as yet how that policy is going to be delivered. But are those voters in the seats that the Liberals need to win back to take government?
It's possible that there will be some, and it depends on the household pressures. It depends on things like inflation and interest rates and, you know, other things that are adding to household pressures. But the last election was pretty clear. Labor had a very, in the last two elections, really, Labor's had a very clear position, commitment to action on climate change. The coalition has tried to mirror that to some extent. The coalition has a credibility problem, I think, in this. And we saw, of course, the extraordinary outcome of the election where there's of about 88 metropolitan seats, the coalition holds only 9 of them, or the Liberals hold only 9 of them. So they have a lot of ground to make up. And, of course, Liberals, the few Liberals who do hold metropolitan seats, mostly attest to this being a very significant concern amongst city voters, that is the state of the environment and whatever policies governments are pursuing to address that. That's why a number of them are very concerned about the policy turn they've taken today.
And what about young voters?
Well, that's another thing, isn't it? I mean, I saw someone say today, I can't remember where they said it, but I saw someone say they haven't just lost the next election, they've lost a generation. And I think there's a very real danger that that is the case, because younger voters are, of course, much more aware of this, and they have a much bigger stake in the future as well.
So what do you think this policy reversal is going to mean for Susan Lee's leadership of the Liberal Party?
Her plan to drag the party back toward the middle, I think, is already in a great deal of doubt, and this vote only proves it. And you'd have to say it was always a difficult assignment. She's not done yet. I don't think there's a great advantage for any of her competitors to move too early, but I would have thought that it's not a strong position she's in, and to the extent that she remains there, I think she remains captive to a party room that's now sort of beguiled by what they're seeing around the world, you know, with Nigel Farage and other right-wing populist sort of agitators, people who are prepared to advocate more radical policy, take on culture wars and these kinds of things.
So how big a win do you think it is today, the policy change for her leadership rivals like Angus Taylor and Andrew Hastie?
I think it's a fairly significant win for them.
What do you think will happen in the Liberal Party's meeting with their coalition partner, the Nationals, tomorrow?
Well, I think they're going to try and strive for some sort of condition or set of words, some sort of sophistry which somehow reconciles the idea of not being for net zero by 2050, but remaining in the Paris Accord, remaining in Paris, as they say. I'm not sure. I think it's going to be very hard for Australian voters to understand what that means. It will be interesting to see how the Nats respond to that, because they're less inclined towards even mention of Paris, I would imagine. And they have this this particular, you know, form of words where they say we're against net zero by 2050. They say it is a sort of a disaster for the economy, a disaster for Australian households to have that commitment. But if we were to meet net zero by 2050, if we managed to meet that target anyway, well, that would be welcome. That strikes me as a very curious set of things to try and put together. And somehow between the Libs and the Nats, they're going to try and, you know, stitch all this together and make it sound fairly credible. But I think that's quite an assignment in itself.
Professor Mark Kenny is the director of the Australian Studies Institute at the ANU. This is PM. I'm Samantha Donovan. You can hear all our programs live or later on the ABC Listen app. Australia's unemployment rate has fallen slightly. That's good news for job hunters, but it probably makes it unlikely there'll be an interest rate cut anytime soon. The Bureau of Statistics jobless rate was 4.3% at the end of October, down from 4.5% a month earlier. The Treasurer, Jim Chalmers, has described the figure as a very positive result. The ABC's business editor, Michael Yander, has more for us on the figures.
Look, obviously we'd seen a big rise in unemployment from 4.3 to 4.5% in the September figures, and these October figures have basically reversed all of that increase. So we've seen unemployment fall back to 4.3% seasonally adjusted. We saw more than 42,000 jobs added over the month of October, according to the ABS. Participation, that is the proportion of Australians in the workforce, either working or looking for work, was steady at 67%. So there's no sort of statistical variations in the unemployment rate around a change in the number of people looking for work. And in fact, hours worked were up 0.5%, which was quite strong for the month. And that meant underemployment also went down. So really a positive set of numbers on the face of it for October.
So the Reserve Bank decided to keep interest rates on hold at its last meeting. What do today's figures mean for the RBA deliberations here on in?
Look, most economists would tell you it really takes a rate cut off the table, certainly for this year, probably for early next year as well. In fact, the markets are now pricing in only about a 40% chance of another rate cut at all in this cycle, so at any point next year. And if it does come, it's likely to be in May or June. A lot of economists are now switching their forecasts, such as National Australia Bank just today on the back of these jobs figures, and saying that they don't expect rates to fall any further in this cycle. The RBA, it must be noted though, has a forecast for the unemployment rate peaking at 4.4%. And the seasonally adjusted figure, if you take it to two decimal places, was 4.34% today. So not far off that. The Reserve Bank really expects unemployment to remain quite steady from here. And if that isn't the case, then it might have to revisit its forecasts and its rates outlook next year.
And Michael, aside from the interest rates question, what are economists saying about the latest numbers and what they tell us about the Australian economy?
Yeah, so as I said, the trend unemployment rate is 4.4%, closer to that actual seasonally adjusted figure of 4.34. What that tells you, that's gone up about one percentage point since the low point post-COVID, and it does fit with the Reserve Bank's picture of a gradually deteriorating jobs market, but one that's still not loose, as they'd call it. But a lot of economists are pointing out that the jobs market might be slowing a little faster than these headline figures suggest. Callum Pickering from employment website Indeed points out that up to this point last year, the Australian economy had created 325,000 jobs. So far this year, it's less than half that at 160,000, and that includes the 42,000 created last month.
The ABC's business editor, Michael Yander. Well, the longest federal government shutdown in US history has come to an end with the signature of the president, Donald Trump. It came after the US House of Representatives voted to pass a spending bill. After 43 days on furlough or working without pay, federal employees are now anxiously waiting for the reinstatement of their pay and entitlements. Elizabeth Cramsey prepared this report.
So with my signature, the federal government will now resume normal operations.
After six long weeks, certainty returned, to some degree at least, for millions of Americans.
And it's an honour now to sign this incredible bill and get our country working again.
With the stroke of a very large Sharpie, President Donald Trump effectively sent hundreds of thousands of federal employees back to work.
Tell the American people you should not forget this when we come up to midterms and other things. Don't forget what they've done to our country.
Forgetting 43 days of disruptions to air travel, food stamps and, of course, salaries seems unlikely. The crucial moment came earlier when a spending package was passed by the Republican-controlled lower house with the help of six Democrats.
On this vote, the yeas are 222, the nays are 209. The bill is passed.
And House Speaker Republican Mike Johnson lays the blame for the long shutdown at the feet of those opposite.
Absolutely no question in anybody's mind now that the Democrats were responsible for this. What happened? Millions of American families went without food on their table. You had millions of Americans stranded in airports, their flights canceled and delayed. You had troops and federal employees wondering where their next paycheck would come from.
The crisis began when Democrats wanted the spending bill to include an extension of expiring tax credits, which, through the Affordable Care Act, made health insurance cheaper. And they also wanted to reverse cuts to Medicaid, which gives health cover to Americans who are elderly, living with disability, or low-income earners. But Republicans wanted to debate the health insurance subsidies separately and rejected anything outside what they called a clean resolution. That resulted in 670,000 federal workers being furloughed and 730,000 working without pay. But Minority Leader Democrat Hakeem Jeffries says his party will continue its push for healthcare subsidies.
We will continue to fight to lower the high cost of living. House Democrats will continue to fight to address the healthcare crisis that Republicans have created.
And he warns the fight is ultimately in the hands of the American people.
Either Republicans finally decide to extend the Affordable Care Act tax credits this year, or the American people will throw Republicans out of their jobs next year and end the speakership of Donald J. Trump once and for all. That's how this fight ends.
But until that time, House Speaker Mike Johnson will take the win.
Thank you all. We got the government open. Let's celebrate tonight.
The Speaker of the US House of Representatives, Mike Johnson. Elizabeth Cramsey with that report. In many communities around the country, youth crime is a major issue. In Victoria this week, the government's toughened its policy, promising adult time for violent crime. In Western Australia's remote Kimberley region, the town of Kununurra has seen a recent spike in youth crime and extra police have been flown in. But community leaders are hoping they can find other ways to tackle challenges facing local children. This report from Julia Bertolio.
It's a quiet night in Kununurra as these police officers find two 8-year-old girls wandering the streets.
Oh, look who it is.
What's up?
Well, you're not meant to be here.
The girls tell the officers they have nowhere safe to go, so the officers put them in the police van. And after trying a few addresses, the officers cannot find the responsible adult to take them in, so they take them back to the station. The community in Kununurra is looking for ways to address the challenges affecting children. In response to a spike in youth crime, extra police have been flown into Kununurra to assist. But locals know the answers must come from within. Jaru Gija woman Temali Howard spent nearly two decades working in youth justice. But now she owns a cafe, which she runs as a social enterprise providing training and employment.
We have the answers here. Aboriginal people have the answers. We just need to be engaged with in meaningful ways that help create outcomes.
She believes grassroots initiatives like hers can help children.
It comes back to, you know, working with families. We're working with intergenerational trauma issues. Healing has to be part of the solution.
It's a solution driven by locals. Bunuba Gija man John O'Farrar is a youth worker with the Woonan Foundation.
As a young Indigenous person here in Kununurra, they look up and they find another Aboriginal person and say, yeah, well, it might not be that hard if we can do it.
Lawyer Sally Oliver from the Aboriginal Legal Service says removing children from families that need support does not address the root causes of youth crime and other problems.
The idea that you can remove children and place them in separate homes or put them in secure placements and the offending will stop, that's not true.
There are safe spaces for children in Kununurra, but they're not open 24/7. A new night space is due to open next year to provide support throughout the night, and the community hopes that combined with other initiatives, it will help keep children safe.
Julie Battaglio reporting from Kununurra in WA. Thanks for joining me for PM. I'm Samantha Donovan. The podcast of the full program is on the ABC Listen app, and we'll be back at the same time tomorrow. Good night.
Hi, it's Sam Hawley here, host of the ABC News Daily Podcast. The longest government shutdown in American history is coming to an end. Today, political scientist Charles Hunt from Boise State University on why a small group of Democrats ended up giving Donald Trump exactly what he wanted. Look for the ABC News Daily Podcast on the ABC Listen app.